Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show, the show dedicated to discovering the jewels of wisdom used for increasing ROI for REIs. That is, return on investment for real estate investors. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 108 with Reed Goossens on raising $9.5 million for multifamily investment. Reed came to the U.S. from Australia in 2012 to pursue a career in structural engineering and discovered that we have a much lower barrier to entry to begin investing in real estate here than back home in Australia. So after buying a triplex and a few duplexes, Reed decided it would make more sense to scale up quickly his rents and values by buying hundreds of units at a time instead of two or three. Fast forward a few years and Reed now only buys large multifamily assets exceeding a few hundred units per deal. We will dissect his most recent acquisition here on today's show, a 253-unit building in San Antonio, Texas, which he is planning to turn around and exit in about 5 years for a projected profit of more than $10 million. Let's get to it. Reed, welcome to the REI Diamond Show. How are you doing today?
G'day, mate. Thank you for having me.
So I'm sure some of the listeners who don't know you figured out you are not from the United States with that the way you introduced yourself there. Do you want to give people a little background of where you're recording from and then also where you're from and how you got here?
Right, yeah, my accent down by West Texas, right, the deep south. I'm originally from Australia, and I'm recording from Los Angeles today. It is stiflingly hot. But yeah, I moved to the United States about 6 or 7 years ago, and I'm sure we're going to get into that story. But today, coming to you from Los Angeles.
Nice. And I am here in Chicago, right on the lake. It's like probably 68 degrees, a little breezy, and the waves are pretty big. Myself, we're midsummer here. That should be expected, I guess, for both of our climates, temperature-wise, right?
Right, right. Exactly. Loving the summer.
Cool. So, Reed, for those that don't know who you are, do you want to give the background Reader's Digest version as to how you got to where you are today and what your business looks like today?
Yeah, sure. So, again, I'm originally from Australia. I moved to the United States about 6 or 7 years ago. I fell in love with two things when I first came to the United States back in 2009. I was actually backpacking through the United States. And I fell in love with New York City, but I also fell in love with a girl who is now my wife. So I moved to the United States, fell in love in 2009, went back to Australia, and then, you know, got the bug for real estate investing, and then, you know, packed up my life, quit my job, and moved halfway across the world to the Big Apple with my girlfriend, who's now my wife, Erica. So that's what brings me to the United States originally. My background's in structural engineering and construction management. I studied structural engineering at university, and have spent a better part of a decade being a professional, working across the globe. Some of the highlights include being a structural engineer on the 2012 Olympic Games back in 2008 in London. And I've worked in Thailand, Australia, United States, obviously Europe, all across the globe in ground up construction, predominantly multifamily infrastructure. And but when I moved to the United States, I fell in love with the fact that, you know, for everyone who's listening to your show, mate, that United States has such a lower barrier to entry for investing in real estate than, you know, other countries, other first world countries like Australia, like Europe, like Canada. So, you know, for your listeners who are sitting on the fence, make sure, like, get off the fence and understand, you know, why the United States is such a fertile ground for investing. And you know, when I first moved here in 2012, I just realized that, you know, I could pick up my first property I picked up was for like $38,000, and it was a triplex. And on paper, it cash flowed incredibly well. I cut my teeth, you know, investing in triplexes and duplexes and flipping some houses. And fast forward 6 years, I own my own real estate company, RSN Property Group, and I'm a co-founder of Wildhorn Capital. and we buy and syndicate large multifamily assets across the southeast, and also try to attract international investors to these shores because of the great returns and cash flow that the United States offers. So a little bit of a nutshell of what I am and what I do.
Interesting. Yeah, that was a good burning question for me. Why did you move to the U.S.? And it was a pretty understandable answer there for Erica.
Exactly.
That's cool. So could you shed a little bit of light on why is the barrier to entry lower here? What is it that makes the U.S. have this lower barrier to entry? Is it simply price? Is it something else I'm not aware of? I mean, fill me in on that.
Yeah, so if we take a look at the United States, compared just to, say, Australia, we're just going to do try to do as much apples to apples as we possibly can. So in Australia, we have a similar land mass, the same as the mainland United States, or roughly, excluding Alaska, you're the same land mass, right? Let's just call it equal. However, in the United States, you have about 400 million people, and you can inhabit the entire country. There's not many places you can't inhabit. In Australia, we have about 24, 25 million people, and we're defined to the four or five major cities in Australia, which are coastal cities. The interior of Australia is completely arid. You cannot live there. And because of that, the low population, where you can live, it forces house prices through the roof. So cash flow is just not an option. Think of the United States investment market like an LA or a San Francisco or a New York style market, very, very high barriers to entry, doesn't really cash flow a lot. You don't have your, Kansas City, Missouri's. You don't have your Texas's, your San Antonio's, your Charlotte, North Carolina's, your parts of Chicago where you can invest. And so, and the reason that you guys have these, what I like to call secondary markets, is because you have such a larger population, and that larger population forces people into these secondary and tertiary markets from employment reasons, for cost of living. And so from an apples, 30,000 foot apples to apples comparison, the United States just has a larger population, a more diverse, what I like to call markets or sub-markets, compared to, say, Australia, which is very defined by its cities, and we're sort of landlocked, which forces prices up, and there's not a lot of cash flow. So in Australia, it's more of an appreciation play, development play. In the United States, you have the best of both worlds. You could invest in LA, you can try to, the appreciation route, or you can invest in a secondary or tertiary market like Kansas City or Charlotte, North Carolina, and you can have some pretty good cash flowing opportunities. So does that answer the question?
It does. So my assumption, what I'm understanding here, is that in Australia, it's going to be mostly like an owner-occupied person who's definitely emotionally attached to the property and paying a emotionally or a non-logical price, certainly from us, the way we look at it from the point of view of an investor, right?
Well, yes and no. We definitely still have investments in Australia. We have a lot of Asian money coming into Australia because of just the close proximity. So people invest in Australia predominantly for tax purposes, to lower their tax risk. So you may not invest for cash flow. You may invest just to reduce your taxable liability in Aussie. So a lot more fix and flipping goes on in Australia, but not as much buy and hold. There is buy and hold, but it's not as much for buy and hold to cash flow and get the tax appreciation. You sort of got the double pronged sword here in the United States. In Australia, it's more just for the tax component of it to harbor and shelter your money from inflation and stuff like that.
Gotcha. And we do see a lot of that dynamic here in California with some of the Asian money. We see it in New York City with international money that are driving prices up. And along the coastline in Miami, it's the same kind of phenomenon where people are using them as like a land banking strategy, just a place to put the cash.
Exactly.
It doesn't necessarily make sense on paper like that triplex you bought for $38,000. You did say that, and you said on paper, and I wrote that down because I'm wondering if when you actually bought it, the $38,000 triplex didn't actually work out the way it was underwritten. Could you enlighten me on that one?
Yeah, so for the first 6 months it did. It was great. It was all bells and whistles, but the problem boiled down to the type of tenant base that I was essentially getting into my properties. And given that I was What I'd learned, what I now have learned looking back, is that buying in those sort of markets, you're sort of attracting sort of Section 8 housing, and through Section 8 housing, you can attract a little bit of issues from a tenant basis. Not that all tenants are bad, but just in the experience with this triplex, we ended up having a drive-by shooting, and it wasn't great. So we only ended up holding it for about 18 months, and I got out of it. I didn't lose any money, but it didn't make, you know, the lofty cash flow that I sort of had projected to be, like, you know, $1,200 a month. It sort of really was on more like $300 or $400 a month, and it came down to tenants and the tenant profile, and then, you know, trying to get my property management to look, you know, make sure that they're spending their time and effort on that. But given it's only a $30,000 property, you know, they're not going to clearly spend a lot of time on, you know, on my property. So, you know, looking back on it, it was purely a scale thing. I did end up picking up about another two duplexes, both at about $45,000, and they worked perfectly on paper. They what they did on paper, they actually did in reality. But the big thing learning was that it was, what was the best use of your money to, you know, to place it? Was it to place it in this asset that had a lot of deferred maintenance and all that sort of stuff? So just a lot of lessons were learnt through owning about three or four duplexes and triplexes in upstate New York.
Okay. Do you still own those properties now, or did you jettison those?
No, I have completely exited those assets, and I used the money to try my hand at fix and flipping in Philadelphia. And I, you know, was a little bit successful there, and then I've used that money to subsequently get into multifamily and commercial real estate, where it really makes sense from my point of view, NOI, syndication, that sort of stuff. So that's where my path. I started with the smaller stuff, moved through to fixing and flipping, moved through to then the large commercial assets.
Gotcha. So my personal experience here, just yesterday I was out to lunch with a friend of mine here in Chicago, and he was telling me that he's got a reasonable interest rate line of credit right now of about $50 million that he can use for buying single family assets here in Chicago from Goldman Sachs. And I'm thinking, it sounds like a great thing up front. We do 40, 50 deals a month, my company, Diamond Equity Investments. And we scaled slowly to that point over time. So I'd say the last 4 years solid, we've been, you know, organizing the team, structuring our processes, figuring out our ways to evolve and scale up to that number. And it's posed me, I haven't stopped thinking about that number because he's, you know, I was sharing that we probably put 25% of our revenue goes back into advertising to generate the new deals. And he was like, okay, so that's, you know, $12 million in advertising, $10 million in advertising. I'm like, oh, no, there's no way you could scale to that number of doing, you know, putting that $50 million to work in single family. My reaction was just like yours. Wow. But, you know, the questions continuing to burn on my mind, is there a way to, you know, scale to a number of even $10 million, which is kind of high for a line of credit, let alone $50 million? And I feel myself trying to evolve the systems and the people and the responsibilities to go from, I think we did just under $4 million in revenue, to even a number of 10 would take a different structure of the team and a different performance from everybody. Mm-hmm. But it seems like you had a similar evolution, maybe not the exact specifics of what I just talked about there, but to go from, you know, the handful of units that you sold, put the cash back into these multifamily syndication deals. Can you talk about maybe a few of the enlightening moments along the way as the evolution for you took place and you started to view your own investment activities with an eye towards scaling?
Yeah, I think it's a good question, because it's a part and parcel of having that small, very small portfolio of what I would call small multifamily. I did see that, you know, when I bought that triplex, that if I went in and I spent a little bit of money, I could increase my rent. You know, I think the rent, it was renting it at the time for $550, and I ended up increasing it by $75 across the three units. That was through sort of very cosmetic rehab stuff that I wasn't, you know, spending maybe $4,000 a unit putting in new flooring, a bit of paint, you know, maybe some black appliances, nothing crazy. And through that, I got to see, well, hang on, that's pretty powerful by shifting that, you know, just the rent. And at the same time, a buddy of mine came down from Canada, and I was sort of went out to one. I remember it was the Christmas of 2013, and I went out to dinner with him, and I said, "Oh, you know, guess what I'm doing? I'm buying all these great properties in upstate New York, and I'm killing it. I've got three of them, or whatever I had at the time." He said, "Reed, that's incredible. Congratulations." And he went on to said, "Oh, I just closed on a 70 unit property," and I said, "How the hell did you close on 70 units? Like, what money did? Like, where's all this money?" And he's like, "Well, I used syndication, and I used." You know, the same formula what I was just saying is like you go in, you increase, you put some money into the units per unit, and then you increase the rent. And through increasing the rent, you're increasing the net operating income. And in the commercial world, which is for your listeners out there, 5 units or more, the bank views it like a business. So if you increase the gross income, i.e. the rent, then you're going to increase the value of the property. Now, in the smaller multifamily, I didn't have that it doesn't work as nicely as that. But my buddy was sort of then explaining to me about how the power of, you know, other people's money, friends and family, getting into a lower risk asset because like I had experience in a triplex, one person moves out, that's a third of my revenue gone. And if I can, you know, reduce that risk over say 10, 20, 50, 100 units, then the chances of all those, you know, say it's a 50 unit property, the chances of all 50 tenants leaving at once is a lot lower risk, and so the bank can view it as a business. But then the natural question is asked is, well, how the hell do you make that transition? I've just been using all my own money. The bank doesn't want to lend to me anymore because I was quote unquote foreign. I didn't have a good credit score and all that sort of stuff. But he then explained to me the power of OPM, other people's money, and pooling together maybe 3 or 4, 5, 6 friends and family, you know, all putting $100,000 down and then going out and buying a larger asset, a reduced risk. He acted as the managing member, and he took a smaller sliver, but it was of a larger asset. And so his net worth was growing up. He's also was able to leverage other people's abilities and for bringing equity to the table. And in return, they got a decent return on investment. So it was sort of like a win-win for everyone. And that was the real aha moment that I had in my career, and then, you know, from there I went out and, you know, seeked a mentor, and the rest is history, as they say.
Nice, that makes sense. So, you know, these days if we did like the 80-20 rule, like I make 80% of my money from 20% of my deals, I wish I could focus on those 20, and I do seek to try to target the 20% that's always producing, you know, the higher income. If you find that same 80-20 rule to apply, or you have, you know, a chunk of your operational revenue for your companies or even your personal investment, like what deals are they coming from today? Like, where are you making your money and focusing your effort? Where are you applying your high value skill sets to see the most results in 2018, Reed?
Yeah, it's all comes down to syndication, and you know, we just closed on a 253 unit property. We're looking at a portfolio, two assets in the same submarket of over 500 units. And that there is really where I'm focusing my time and effort. I get that 80-20 rule. I get most bang for my buck by going and taking down these larger assets. Again, I take a smaller sliver of ownership because I'm spreading it between more investors. But the fact is I'm doing 400, 500, 600 units at a time means that I can do that. Get back to that 80-20 rule. I'm scaling my net worth. I'm scaling the properties under ownership and under management. And through that, I get, you know, fees and, you know, asset management fees and all that sort of stuff that help drive the business forward and keep the lights on and all that sort of good stuff. And then from that, I can then create other businesses that are recession proof and not necessarily as reliant upon acquiring assets as, you know, as and I can talk a whole bunch of about that, you know, in an episode about, you know, you know, ecosystems and all that sort of stuff. You know, like we did when you were on my show.
I like it. Do you want to give a few examples of it without all the details?
Yes.
Some other ancillary businesses you're interested in?
So, like with your business, Dan, it's, you know, once you get to a scale point of view, you can potentially take on property management. If you want to take that on as property manager, I currently pay a third party property manager to run my asset. They're professional based commercial grade, property management team. Now each of my assets has a payroll, and that payroll are the employees on site. Could I take that on board and control that piece of it? Yes, I could. Now, do I want the headache of being a property manager? Maybe not, but the option is there. The other option is, you know, from a business point of view, is I can become a supply, you know, direct supply from China or Mexico in terms of like cheap flooring and light fixtures and plumbing fixtures and all that sort of stuff instead of going to Home Depot or Lowe's where I have been going the last couple of years. I can go and like get shipping containers directly from China and potentially through the other people that I know in my sphere, I can direct sell to them and become a supplier of building materials. Again, that is people a little bit, it's not irrelevant, but it's not as dependent on me owning the asset. I could also create a business where I can just be a complete on-seller or a supplier or a wholesaler to other friends that I know in the industry, which can create a profit for me. There's also the potential, you know, on every project we do, we spend, you know, $2 to $3 million repositioning, you know, 200 units over a period of 12 months. I hire a third party GC. I could go out and start my GC company if I wanted to. There's all these different business ecosystems that I can create that feed off one another that I'm currently, you know, paying third parties that I could bring in house. But then you've got to ask yourself, well, if I'm going to have a life how I want to have my life, do I want to have all the liabilities of having employees or you know a lot of employees, which then means I've got to go get payroll and keep them their mouths fed and food on the table for them. So it's a little bit of I have the ability to do and pick and choose what types of businesses I you know will get into, like material supply business, for example. That's a very low person people business where I don't need a lot of bodies to make that business work efficiently. But on the other hand, something like a GC, you know, company, you need a lot of bodies to make it effective. You know, if you're doing siding repairs, or you're doing, you know, you're turning units, or you're doing painting, that creates a lot of bodies, which then creates a lot of mouths to feed, and having to be a sustainable business is then you're not working on your business, you're working in the business, and that's something that you know I'm very cognitive of when I look to plan for the future, is making sure that I'm being the puppeteer, not necessarily being the puppet, if that makes sense.
Gotcha. So can we walk through an example of the syndication deal you just closed on the 253 unit property? In which market was that?
That was in San Antonio, Texas. Yeah, sure. So we raised I think about $9.5 million in equity. It was a $20 million acquisition. We raised all the CapEx dollars from that, and we also got agency debt on the deal. We're low leveraged. The reason we have a low leverage is because we, you know, if the deal can pencil at low leverage, then that means that it's less risk to our investors. So we actually bought that asset from the same person who sold us the previous asset. So we had a good rapport with them. We were not the highest bidder, but because of that rapport and that professionalism that we try to bring to each and every deal, they were really happy with working with us again. It was quite painless on their end. But we also knew what type of deal we were buying from them because of the experience with the last deal we bought from them. So very much a blank canvas, 1980s assets. Haven't really been touched, you know, really primed to come in and completely reposition, rebrand the property and, you know, create a new feel and bring in professional property management. So the story was definitely there in order to really push the needle of that NOI, as I spoke about earlier.
Let's talk about the $9.5 million. Let's just pretend that I have $250,000 in capital. I'm coming to the table. How's my money protected? What kind of returns do I expect? How long is my money locked up? What's my total cash on cash return at the end of the set period of time that you guys are going to turn this around and then exit?
Yep. So think of a pie, and that pie is a sphere. So that is split up. Investors own 70% of the deal, and me and my business partner, own 30% of the deal, and we oversee the day-to-day the property management and the day-to-day asset management and the repositioning. For the money that they invest in the deal, they get what's called a preferred return. And a preferred return is you can't guarantee returns in any investment, but sort of the next best thing. And we give an 8% preferred return every year. And the idea is that we are looking for assets that will produce about a 15% or greater IRR over a 5-year hold. With an average of 8.5 to 9% cash on cash every year. And we look to try and double our investors' money in 5 years' time. That's the projection, at least. And you ask the question, how are they protected? Well, they're protected a number of ways. Is that we only ever get non-recourse debt on our properties. We don't get any recourse debt. So investors aren't asked to sign on the loan. We, as me and my business partner and our other key principals, bring the loan to the table. So we take on that risk ourselves personally, but it is non-recourse again. So the only time it becomes recourse is if you do anything fraudulent, particularly carve-outs. And we use, you know, agency debt, Freddie and Fannie agency debt, low leverage, fixed terms for 7 to 10 years. And then the other protection we have is that every asset we buy, we create a new standalone LLC, and then investors invest into that LLC, which will then own the asset. So in a nutshell, it's eight, you know, an 8% pref, look to try and double investors' money in 5 years' time, and they're protected through a number of ways of low leverage. The LLC, they're not actually got nothing to do with the debt itself, and they're sitting in second position after the bank. So, yeah.
So are they ownership shares of the LLC, so they get tax benefits of owning the property as well?
Correct. All flow through tax benefits. Any cost segregation we do on our assets goes straight through to the investor. It's all flow through.
What are the loan to value limits these days to qualify for non-recourse debt, Reed?
Yeah, so it depends. The big thing that agencies like to look for is what's called a DCR factor. So the debt service coverage ratio, I didn't say that right, but you're looking at a 1.25 or greater on the pro forma. And if you can get a 1.25 or greater, which means that the ratio of NOI to debt payments, so meaning there's a 25% buffer in NOI compared to the debt payments, then that agency lending will come on board. You also have to be 80% occupied or greater, and that's 80% economic vacancy. And that's when agencies, federal government agency lending will come on board. Typically, they will lend to a maximum of 75% loan to value. And that's why we typically pick it up at around 70% loan to value, but we also then raise our CapEx dollars through equity. So the overall leverage on loan to cost is about 65 to 66% over an asset. And again, if we can get the deal to pencil with that low leverage, and again, we're in control of the CapEx dollars. It's a lever we like to pull in order to be in control, because, you know, if something happens in the future, you know, with the economy may fall off the side of a cliff, we are in control of those CapEx dollars and not the bank, and we can press pause and, you know, restart those CapEx and renovation process, you know, after, you know, whatever has happened in the economy. So, and again, being low leveraged, we're not a great risk of being what's called upside down in the debt, what happened back in 2008 to many, many, many homeowners and people in real estate.
Smart to mitigate the risk. Who actually signs the checks and has this account sitting there at the $3 million or so CapEx dollars while you're investing that money?
That's what me and my business partner do. We are the asset managers. We are the managing members of the LLC. We're the custodians. So we oversee all the accounting. We oversee all the dollars in and dollars out of those bank accounts. And, you know, every quarter we give a financial update to investors, and we do an audit every 6 months, third party audit. And if investors ever want to, you know, audit themselves, they're more than happy to do it. You know, we don't have anything to hide. So we're very transparent with everything we do, because again, this is other people's money. It's obviously also our money, but we take very, very good care of it.
Absolutely. So this would be roughly, I think, a $10 million gross profit upon sale. Is that what this one would pencil out to?
Probably more than that. So we're picking it up at about $80,000 a door. And we're looking to exit at about $115,000 a door, remembering that the price or the exit price is based on the NOI and what we can shift. We're looking for about a 20% shift in NOI over a period of 4 to 5 years, which is pretty conservative based on the in-place rents and what the market is getting for a renovated product. So that's really what the business plan comes down to, is what is the market, can the market bear? How are we underwriting to that in terms of price per square foot on the rent, in terms of the absolute rent values? And then, you know, what type of renovations to achieve those higher rents? Is it, you know, new vinyl flooring? Is it new two-tone paint? Is it stainless steel, or is it black appliances? Is it resurfaced countertops or quartz countertops? And that's what we have to gauge as a business model to then, in order to go and, you know, renovate a unit for, say, $5,000 or $6,000 a unit, and then look to try and get a rental bump of about $125 to $170, depending on the unit type across the board. And that takes a period of time to go, obviously, go through the entire property and do, you know, execute that business plan. But that's why we're holding it for 5 years.
Nice. So in the meantime, you know, Reed, from your perspective personally, do you do flips still on the side? Is there enough cash flow from these scaled up deals to live on? I mean, do you still do the engineering thing? How do you cover your day to day in the interim until we get to our 5 days out?
Well, that's what the point is of the, you know, we get upfront fees for being the custodians and bringing the deal to investors. And we get an asset management fee as quarterly distributions go to investors. We also get a quarterly distribution being the asset manager. Again, the 70-30, we are 30% ownership in the deal. So we get, you know, after the preferred return is met, we get 30% of all cash flows after that. So plus the asset management fee. So that's what keeps the lights on, so to speak, and that's what keeps us paid and make sure that, you know, we keep our team fed.
Gotcha. Sounds good. What have been the best deal sources? Maybe you'd share the source of how this one came across your desk, but for finding these multifamily deals.
Yeah, it's a good question. There's definitely, you know, with like in single family, I've been through the single family route of, you know, yellow lettering and direct cold calling. In the commercial space, it doesn't work as well because if you are a commercial owner, you're probably a little bit more sophisticated than the average investor. So, you know, you're going to go to the big brokerage houses to sell your asset. It's, you know, sometimes there's rare chances where you get a mum and pop owner that have owned it for 30 years and they just want to sell directly to the seller and they don't have to go through the rigmarole of marketing it. But 9 times out of 10, given where we are in the market cycle, brokerage firms, you know, the big ones, CBRE, ARA, Walker Dunlop, you know, all those big sort of guys, they're where we go to for all our property, all our deals. And it's just really through developing close relationships with the local on boots on the ground brokers in our specific markets, taking them out to lunch, taking them out to golf, and making sure we're seeing assets before they hit the market. And having, you know, making sure that we're getting a first look at the apple, so to speak, before, you know, it gets mailed out to everyone else. So typically, you know, it's taken many years to get to this point, but we are now seeing in certain markets, key markets that we're in, we're definitely seeing sort of sneak peeks, maybe week and a half before it's blasted out to every man and his dog. But, you know, so we get a bit of a head start on other people, and not all assets we want to take down because it just may not fit our return profile. It may not fit our growth strategy. So, but we definitely, you know, for every 10 or 20 deals we underwrite, we will probably put an offer in on 5. And for of those 5, we try to close on 1 or 2, every quarter. So yeah.
Cool. What are the favorite 2 or 3 markets and why?
So we really like the Texas markets, Dallas, San Antonio, Houston. We like Atlanta. I do like Phoenix a little bit. I also like the Carolinas, some markets in the Carolinas. Again, it goes back to the perspective that I bring from being an outsider, seeing that, you know, people are getting these, you know, everyone's sort of concerned about cap rates, you know, in commercial, you know, dropping to 5 or 6%. But you've got to remember that, you know, I come from a country where cap rates are low, like they are in New York and LA, of like 1% and 2%. So when you're still in markets where you can get between 5% and 6% cap rates on, you know, relatively newish 1980s to 2000s built assets, and I can get fixed rate debt on it, and that the interest rate's about 100 basis points lower than the market cap rate, I'm still going to be able to make cash flow. I'm still going to be able to make money for my investors. So I also look for strong GDP growth. I look for multiple employers in the areas. I typically don't invest in markets with less than 500,000 people or less because it's too small of a market for me. I like to be plus 500. So you really want to see path of progress. I'm very bullish on the San Antonio market, just given the corridor between Austin and San Antonio. I think in 10 to 12 years time, that's going to be the new Dallas-Fort Worth. It's just completely booming, 4 lanes each way. And we're on the north side of San Antonio headed into to Austin. So I think we're going to see in the next, as I said, 10 to 12 years, a real boom in that area and really become one sort of metroplex, similar to the growth and story of Dallas-Fort Worth. In other markets, I also like to see where the path of progress is. We definitely spend a lot of time vetting markets. We'll spend between 6 to 12 months getting to know a market, boots on the ground, you know, talking to local people, really getting to know the brokers before we'll even start making offers on properties. And we'll probably start making offers a little bit sooner than that, but it's just more to get a feedback from the brokers and get them to see that we're serious about, you know, we take everything that we do from underwriting to making offers very, very seriously. And, you know, we're closers at the end of the day because, you know, the brokers don't want to deal with Yahoos. So we really pride ourselves in making sure that we say what we mean and we perform and we take action and you know, go out and close on deals.
Nice. So if I or someone maybe just getting started or has been successful in real estate, one or two book recommendations for the beginner and for someone who's been at the game for a while.
Yeah. So early in my career, I picked up the book Rich Dad Poor Dad, actually after I was backpacking through the United States back in 2009, go back to Australia. And I sort of said to myself, how the hell do I, you know, live my life how I want to live and get paid to travel the world? And essentially it was, you know, making my money work for me. And the Rich Dad Poor Dad book was definitely, that was the first book. And that's a good entry level book for anyone who's on that end of the scale. For other people who are more into business ecosystems and all that sort of stuff, there's many books I can recommend. Tony Robbins' Money is a really fantastic book. Sort of more gets into a little bit more of the nitty gritty. There's some other great people out there that I follow that talk a little bit more, like the Warren Buffetts of the world, that talk a little bit more minutia and granular. It may be good bedtime reading. It may put some people to sleep, but if you're into that and you're on the more sophisticated level, definitely recommend, you know, following the Buffetts of the world, the Tony Robbins of the world in terms of, you know, their money management strategies and stuff like that.
Nice. If you could go back and share the crown jewel of wisdom with your 18-year-old self, what would that be, Reed?
I think the crown jewel of wisdom is always, you know, and I pretty much lived up to this, you know, not trying to toot my own horn, but always live up to or always be willing to back yourself. Don't think, so within saying that, it's a two-pronged sword. Always be willing to back yourself, but be willing to learn and shut your mouth and listen to people and surround yourself with people who know better than you. Because at 18, you don't know everything. You don't pretend to know everything. And like all 18-year-olds, we all think we do. So I really encourage people, my 18-year-old self, to really listen more and take note of what people are saying and doing and surround myself with, you know, more influential people. Because as they say, you're the average of the five people that you surround yourself with.
Nice. So if anyone is listening and wants to get some more information about you, would you like to share a website or some contact information?
Yeah, sure thing. You can head over to my website, which is reedgoossens.com. That's reedgoossens.com. You can check out all what I do over there. You can download a free ebook if you want. You can also listen to my podcast, which is called Investing in the US, which I've had you on, Dan. It is a really awesome show. So, yeah, you can hit me up there. If you're ever in LA, you can always hit me up at my email, which is info@reedgoossens.com. I'm always willing to go grab a beer or grab a lunch and just, you know, talk shop.
All right, cool. Hey, Reed, I really appreciate you coming on the show. I got a couple pages of notes here, a lot of great content for the listeners. Thanks for taking time out of your day to be here with the REI Diamonds listeners.
Hey, man, thank you so much for having me on the show. You do an absolutely incredible job. Keep it up.
And thank you, my loyal listener, for tuning in to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. If you're interested in the pre-release of the next episode before the email goes out, please subscribe on YouTube or one of the podcasting apps, including iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher. If you have certain questions or topics you'd like discussed on a future episode, or if you have a guest suggestion, somebody that you'd like me to invite on the show, contact me by clicking on the Contact Dan link at reidiamonds.com. At that site, you can also check out profitable real estate deals I have for sale in my markets, which are Chicago, Philadelphia, Atlanta, Miami, and Tampa. And also the entire archive of the REI Diamond Shows of 108 episodes. Thanks again for tuning in to the REI Diamond Show. Dan Breslin here. Catch you on the next one.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.